know the source of it. Not only that, they wanted to be sure the porters were embroiled in it enough themselves to never be able to point the finger. Angie had once had a debate with her brother. She had been involved in a case where a paedophile had abducted a child. They had caught the man after the damage had been done. Her brother had said that if he were the child's father, he would have found a way to kill the man and would not have turned a hair. Angie had argued that if she were not constrained by the law, she would lock him up forever and personally make every day of his life hell, and she would make sure he stayed alive to experience it. Women are much more cruel beasts, she had explained. Men like to put the sinners out of their misery. Women liked misery to put out the sin. The more she applied all this to the porters, the more she saw a woman's touch. Taking a small torch out of her bag, she made her way into the ruined building, completely ignoring the no-entry signs that the fire service had liberally scattered about. The torch beam brought small areas of destruction into sharp focus. The water that had been used to put out the blaze had been almost as damaging as the fire itself. What the flames hadn't consumed, the blast from the hoses had washed away, finishing the demolition job. A portion of wall had fallen and bits of sodden wallpaper still clung to damp shards of plaster. She shone the torch over it, the last evidence that this ruin had once been a home. The water had washed away some of the soot, and she could still see the ghost of a pattern underneath the grime. There was something else there, part of a word. She stepped closer, almost losing her footing on the rubble. All she could make out were the letters S and U, then the top half of another that may have been an E or an F. The paper below was gone. As she searched around, there were other fragments, but exactly that, just fragments. Nothing complete, no way of divining the meaning. However, something had been written on the walls, and the fire may have been started to make sure that no one ever read it. Either what the fire hadn't destroyed had been washed away, or it had disintegrated as the structure of the building had collapsed in on itself. Nevertheless, she took photographs on her phone of the fragments she had found, and resolved to get somewhere there the next day to salvage what they could. It wasn't a lot, but it was something. A reason why Stella might have died. Ratcliffe had to go and break the news to Francis Haynes about her sisters. One dead, one as near as, damn it. Not that he expected her to react much. So far, she hadn't shown a sliver of family loyalty, and if others were to be believed, she wouldn't start now. Still, it had to be done. Besides, he wanted to do it before she was moved to the prison, where she would be on remand until her trial. Because, despite his theories, if she didn't talk and he didn't find another suspect, she would go to trial and it would be for murder. His gut was telling him that she didn't do it. Not that anyone else was inclined to agree with his theory. He'd run it past Benton first thing, but she wasn't buying it unless he came up with solid evidence. Until then, Stella's murder was a separate issue, not linked until he could prove it otherwise. Francis was waiting for him in an interview room in the company of a young female officer who looked to Ratcliffe like she had just fallen out of the gates of junior school and into a uniform. Were they getting younger, or was he getting too old? After the past few days, he concluded it must be the latter. He offered Francis a cup of tea, but she refused. Then he explained about the fire, about Stella's death, and about Rachel's critical condition. She didn't say anything, but he saw a range of emotions flicker across her face. Shock at Stella's death, then a knowing frown when he mentioned the fire. Possibly a glimmer of concern for Rachel, but too brief to be sure. Then calculation. She was weighing something up in her mind.
"Do you have any questions, or is there anybody you think we should contact?" he asked.
She shook her head, as if his words were an irritating distraction to her thoughts.
"Right, Officer Kelly, we'll escort you back to the custody suite."
He stood up to go, reminded PC Kelly what time the prison transport was due to arrive, and opened the door to leave.
"Wait. There is something. Is Rachel safe?"
Ratcliffe turned to her. "As I've explained, she's seriously ill. Hopefully she will respond and make a recovery, that's all I know."
"Yes, I heard that. I mean, is she safe? Are people with her?"
"I don't really understand what you mean," he said. She let out an impatient sigh.
"You have just told me that my stepsister was murdered. I am simply asking you if you had considered that there might also be a risk to Rachel from the same source."
Given the current physical condition of Rachel Porter, he doubted that a murderer would have much of a job to do. "She is in the ICU, receiving constant care. I think she's safe. Only close family are allowed to visit." "And she is not safe," she said simply.
Ratcliffe sat back down.
Do you have something you would like to tell me, Mrs. Haynes? Possibly. But only if you will give me a guarantee that you will post an officer in the ICU to maintain Rachel's safety. I don't really think you are in a position to make demands. Rachel is quite safe, at least from any external risk. Perhaps if you tell me who you think might pose a threat, I can help. Post an officer first, then I'll tell you everything. Ratcliffe shook his head. Uh-uh. No deal. Anger flashed across her face. You fail to understand me. There is no time. For you to understand the nature of the threat, you will need to hear a long story. By the time I tell it and convince you to protect my sister, it may be too late. I will tell you, but only if you place an officer in the ICU with Rachel at all times until you make an arrest. Ratcliffe mulled it over for a moment. He wasn't in the habit of giving in to such outright manipulation by a prisoner, but he did want whatever information she could give. Okay, I'll send someone down there. But whatever you got better be good. He stepped out into the hallway and rang Angie, told her to get her ass to the ICU and stay with Rachel until she heard different from him. She asked him why, and he told her he didn't have time to explain. She called him something both unmentionable and deeply unprofessional, and said she had information he might find interesting. Tell me later. Haynes is about to spill, and I don't want the window to close while I'm out here arsing about, he said, losing patience and ending the call by pressing buttons on his phone with more pressure than was absolutely necessary, which resulted in him inadvertently switching it off. Back in the interview room, he told Francis that DC Watson would be with Rachel in 10 minutes and would stay by her bedside for as long as she needed to. Francis closed her eyes and breathed in deeply. Then you had better assemble the cabal. Chapter 33 Angie was deeply pissed off. Ratcliffe was being a complete asshole. She had just spent half the morning running around piecing together some decent evidence, and now he wanted her to sit in a hospital and babysit an unconscious woman. She'd had enough of that crap when she had worn a uniform. Still, looking on the bright side, it would give her a chance to mull over what information she had and form it into something coherent. She was going to crack this case if it killed her. Even if death did come in the form of an abject boredom by the bedside of a woman she despised. On the ward, she showed her warrant card, explained her mission, and was shown into the waiting room where she found Charlie Jones, looking 10 years older than he had the day before, and in dire need of a good wash and a shave. "Rough night," she said, hoping that it sounded like sympathy rather than an indictment.
"You could say that. Anything I can help you with?"
"Not really. I'm here to sit with Rachel. Orders from above, just thought I would let you know. Is anybody with her now?"
"Diana and Amy, only two at a time. Why do you need to sit with her?"
She shrugged, turned out her palms. "Ours is not to reason why, etc. My guess is that as Stella was murdered, there might be some concern from the powers that be that Rachel is at risk too."
Charlie snorted in disbelief. "What, in the ICU, surrounded by nurses and her family?"
"Like I said," Angie offered, as if it explained everything. "Perhaps you could take it as an opportunity to go home and get some rest and, whatever," she said, waving her hand at him. He looked down at himself, ran a hand over his stubble and rubbed his eyes.
"Fair point, maybe you're right. They say she's stable now, but you're not going to stop us coming back," he asserted.
"Wouldn't dream of it. Shall I send the others out?"
"Whatever," Charlie said,
his voice blurred by exhaustion. Once they had gone, once she had dealt with the protestations of the daughter and the friend, once she had explained to the staff the reason she was here cluttering up the ward, she was finally able to pull up a chair next to Rachel's bed and gather her thoughts. It had been an interesting morning, at least up until Ratcliffe had phoned. She had been asked to get background on the family, find out if there was anyone in their circle who might have been missed. William Porter's family were all dead, but no one had mentioned whether Valerie Porter still had people. Angie had made it her business to find out. Valerie's maiden name had been Mint, and she'd grown up at the rough end of town, a wartime child. Despite the intervening years and the impact of urban regeneration, it was still the rough end of town, and a familiar stamping ground for anyone in the local police force. Angie had been on more call-outs there than she'd had a clean change of knickers when she'd been in uniform. Given that she changed her underwear daily, it had been an average of 2 incidents a day. She still had clean habits, but didn't visit quite so often. It was a place of petty crime and domestics. Serious incidents were rare. A bit of research had told her that there were still 3 families living in the street where Valerie had grown up, who might have known her as a child or young woman. No relatives had come to light, but these places were close-knit communities where people knew each other's business intimately and had long memories and often strenuous loyalties. That could be a good or a bad thing, depending on the information being sought. Given that even her own children had given Valerie a bad rap, Angie was hoping she hadn't been popular as a kid. That way, it was more likely someone would choose to dish the dirt. Her first port of call had been number 23, the home of Mrs. Bolan and her daughter. Having rung the bell, she'd waited patiently by the door, her warrant card ready in her hand. It had taken a few minutes, but eventually a small, grey-haired woman, who'd peered out past a security chain, had opened the door. Angie had been about to hand over her warrant card and introduce herself when a high-pitched, querulous voice had cut across her words.
"Who's there? Who's there at the door, Pam?"
Pam had given Angie an apologetic look, then turned and called down the passage.
"It's a lady from the police. What does she want? Is it about those thugs who broke the back fence a bit late, aren't they?"
"I don't know what she wants, Mother. I can't hear her over your shouting," she called in exasperation, and then turned back to Angie. "Is it about the fence?" Angie had smiled. "No, not the fence, I'm afraid. I wanted to talk to you and your mother about Valerie Mint. She used to live a few doors away."
"Valerie Mint," Pam had repeated,
rolling the name over her tongue as if it might taste the way it sounded. "Now there's a name I haven't heard for a long time." She turned back into the hallway.
"She wants to know about the mints." "Mints? What mints?"
the inner voice demanded in a pitch that had made Angie want to wince.
"Not mints, the mints, the family that used to be down the road."
There was silence from the back of the house. "Do you think I might come in?" Angie had asked, her neck getting stiff from angling her head to peer through the gap in the door. Pam had shut the door and let off the chain, then ushered Angie through the door with a surreptitious glance down the street to see if anyone was watching. "Mother's in the back room," she'd said, leading Angie down a dingy passageway to the back of the house. It was a typical Victorian terraced house, stairs straight ahead, front room, back room, kitchen, bathroom. Most houses in the area had been modernized, the rooms knocked through, the kitchens extended, the bathrooms put upstairs. However, this one retained its original layout and looked like it hadn't been decorated since the 70s. Pam's mother had sat regally in a winged back chair, a rug over her knees made from hundreds of different bubble-textured crochet squares. Her brown speckled hands had rested nervously on the arms of her chair, and her thin lips were set in a defiant line. Angie had introduced herself, showed her card again, and asked if she might sit down. The old woman had nodded and indicated an uncomfortable-looking cottage-style settee. Angie had sat, the ancient springs groaning with every movement. "I was wondering if you might be able to recall anything about the Mint family. They lived here some years ago. We're currently investigating a case connected to Valerie Mint, or Valerie Porter, as she was after she married. I was hoping to find someone who could tell me a bit about the family. It often helps us if we have some background," she'd explained. The old woman had nodded.
"Does it now?"
she'd said. It was hardly a conversation opener.
"Would you like a cup of tea, officer?" Pam had offered, hovering by the kitchen door.
"It's detective, and thank you, that would be lovely."
While Pam had bustled about in the tiny kitchen, the old woman just stared at Angie, who'd glanced around the room and given her the occasional smile, hoping to appear undemanding. Finally, Pam came in with a fully laden tea tray, a pot, cups, saucers, milk jug, sugar bowl and biscuits. Custard creams. Angie hated custard creams. Pam had fussed around pouring the tea. She'd looked nervous. The cups had rattled in their saucers as she'd handed first one to Angie, then one to her mother. The old lady had made a great show of stirring it and tapping the spoon on the rim of the cup, as if she'd been about to make a great announcement of some sort.
"So you want to know about the mints?" she'd said, pursing her lips and taking a noisy sip from her cup.
Angie had glanced down and noticed there was a chip in her cup. The china was stained yellow where the glaze was missing. "If you can remember anything about them."
"Huh!" the old woman had uttered. "I remember them all right. Who could forget?"
Then she'd launched into her story, just as Angie had known she would.
"I take it you want to know about Edna Mint, although it all seems to be a bit too long ago to be worrying about what she got up to. She's been dead 30 years.
The woman had chuckled wheezily.
"She weren't Val's mother, she were an aunt. Took Valerie on when her real mother died. Mind you, rumour has it that were down to Edna,"
she'd said with a slow, precise nod of her head. "What was down to Edna?"
"Valerie's mother's death. Died in childbirth, didn't she?"
the old woman had said impatiently, with a shake of her head that implied Angie might be a bit stupid.
Edna was the local woman.
Angie had been completely lost. She'd looked at Pam, afraid of the old woman's censure should she ask for clarity.
Edna was the woman people called on if they were in trouble.
She did the laying out and stuff, Pam had offered, adding about as much clarity as a dollop of mud in a glass of water.
Stuff, Angie had queried.
The old woman flapped her hand impatiently.
Laying out dead people, tending them if they were sick, looking after women in trouble, and she was the local midwife. Not official, like, but the one most people around here preferred. Cheaper than the doctor, see?
She'd taken another noisy slurp of tea.
Back before the war, before the health service and that, you had to pay. She was cheaper. Of course, after the NHS, she had to keep up with the times, not a lot of money and just laying out.
What did she do then? Angie had asked, sipping her own tea tentatively from the opposite side to the chip.
Sorted girls out that had got themselves in trouble. Do it for 3 guineas. That's how she killed off her own sister, dirty habits and infection. Nasty business,
the woman had said with a sniff, fueled by her morality.
You mean she was an abortionist?
The old woman had nodded and Pam had looked away, as if she were ashamed to be associated with such things.
Messed a lot of women up, she did. Surprised your lot never caught her for it. Nasty business. Pam, wasn't she in the picture for Elsie Brent, too?
I don't know, Mother, I can't remember, Pam had said quietly, unable to look either her mother or Angie in the eye.
Of course you do. You, Val, and Dee Dee Brent were thick as thieves.
It was a long time ago, Mother. We were children.
Hardly. You were teenagers when Elsie copped it. Everyone knew she'd fallen again at her age, too. Edna did her in. Her with her gin and knitting needles and her dirty hands.
She didn't use knitting needles. It was a tube thing, Pam had shouted, then realised what she'd said, clapped a hand over her mouth and burst into tears. The old woman had been stunned into silence. Pam had leapt up and run into the kitchen, slamming the door. Angie had found her locked in the toilet.
Pam, come out, it's all right. No one's in trouble, I'm not here for that.
Did something happen with Edna Mint? Did she do something to you? All she'd heard was quiet sobbing from behind the door, so she waited. After a minute or two, Pam undid the door and came out.
We were just kids, she'd said,
her voice husky with emotion. Whatever had happened, she must have been carrying it around with her for an awful long time, Angie had thought. The woman had to be in her late 60s if she was a day.
Do you want to tell me about it?
Maybe it would help her if she did. Maybe it would help Angie if she did. Pam had glanced towards the window. Her mother's wizened face had been peering out from underneath a net curtain, which had been draped over her head like a veil.
She'll never let up on me till I tell her.
Angie had given her a sympathetic smile.
Best get it over with, then, she'd said,
offering a clean but crumpled tissue. It turned out that it wasn't anything to do with Edna Mint, well, not directly, anyway. Dee Dee Brent had been in trouble, not Elsie, her mother. The mother had died of natural causes, ovarian cancer that had swollen her belly so much that everyone thought she was pregnant. Dee Dee hadn't told her family of her own predicament because of her mother's illness, but had sought the help of Edna. Edna had refused to perform the abortion because Dee Dee was too far into the pregnancy, but Val had wanted a new pair of shoes, so took Dee Dee's money and performed the abortion herself, using the equipment her auntie used. She told us it was all right, that she knew what to do, that Edna had shown her how it worked, but she didn't. It was awful and there was blood everywhere. I was only there to help out and look after Dee Dee. The baby was supposed to come away of its own accord, but it didn't, there was just blood. We panicked and I fetched Edna. Then she panicked. Dee Dee was out of it then. Edna and Val, they dumped her in the street and made me phone in an ambulance. Told me I would go to prison as an accomplice if I ever said anything. I was terrified. Angie had needed to dig deep into her bag for another tissue to stem Pam's renewed bout of crying.
What happened to Dee Dee? They took her to hospital, took the baby away there. They took her womb too. Val had really messed her up. She was 15. We were all 15.
Why didn't she report it? Angie wanted to know.
She was ashamed. Her mother was dying. She thought her family would disown her.
But surely they found out she was in hospital, Angie reasoned. Pam shook her head.
Edna went round there, told her dad Dee Dee was staying with them because of her mother being ill. He was grateful. Edna helped him nurse Elsie right up to when she died. Dee Dee stayed in hospital the whole time, never told a soul. Kept her mouth shut even when the doctors called your lot in. She never said a word. Never saw her mum again, either.
She discharged herself the day her mother died. Of course, the doctor came round, told her dad all about it. No confidentiality back then. He beat her black and blue and threw her out on the street and never spoke to her again. Wouldn't even let her go to her own mother's funeral. I don't know what happened to her after that, never saw her again, Pam had said with a loud sniff. Angie had handed her another tissue and wondered who the tears were for, Dee Dee Brent or herself. The old woman had just sat in her chair, shaking her head in disbelief.
Well, 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 was all she'd said.
Angie had been expecting a moral tirade, but Pam's story had shocked her mother into something near silence.
What happened to Edna and Valerie after that?
To be honest, I didn't have much to do with them. I sort of kept my distance from them. I do know that Dee Dee got money from her, money to keep her mouth shut. I can't say I blame her, she had to live on something. As for Val, I know she had a kid, which was weird given what Edna did for money.
Perhaps what happened to Dee Dee put her off, Angie had suggested.
Pam had shrugged.
Dunno, maybe. She married some rich bloke, I know that much.
She got more than she bargained for, though, Angie had thought.
What about Dee Dee? What happened to her?
Pam hadn't known.
Not sure, it's all such a long time ago. We're talking about the 1950s.
The old woman had the answer.
I know what happened to her. She went on the game. Had a pimp called Barrington Jones, big black fella. She'd shacked up with him, supposed to have married him, but I never believed it. He had women all over, poncing on all of them. Nasty piece of work he was, rough. Got himself killed in a fight. They found him dumped in an alley with his head stoved in. I remember that, like it was yesterday, she'd mused.
Ask her what she had for breakfast this morning. She wouldn't be able to tell you, Pam had whispered to Angie with a brave little smile.
The cogs in Angie's mind had been on go slow. It had taken several seconds for her to put two and two together. Was Dee Dee short for Delia, by any chance?
That's right, Delia Brent. We always called her Dee Dee, Pam had said before blowing her nose loudly into her tissue.
Angie had certainly established the link between Valerie Porter and Delia Jones, and quite a disturbing one at that. Now, sitting here at Rachel's bedside, she wondered if William Porter had known that he was marrying an abortionist's daughter, well, niece, to be correct, but even so. She wouldn't mind betting that Valerie had kept that quiet from her new family. The story definitely explained the connection between the two women, and gave quite a picture of Valerie's early years. What it didn't explain was Delia's loyalty to the Porters. By right, she should hate them. Valerie had ruined her life, might well have killed her. No wonder Valerie had felt obliged to employ her. It would have been the least she could do. It was only at this stage, as she was mulling things over, pitching the story in her head, that an obvious fact occurred to her. Charlie. If Pam had been telling the truth about Delia, how on earth had Charlie come into the picture? She needed to get hold of Ratcliffe, talk it through with him. Surely it wouldn't hurt if she left the ward for a few minutes. After all, she didn't even know what she was doing there in the first place. Did Ratcliffe think Rachel was going to come round and reveal some big secret that would be the final key to the whole case? Chapter 34 Ratcliffe had drafted in another DC to assist with the interview. D.I. Benton wasn't around, besides she'd shown a decided lack of interest in the twists and turns of this case, so he'd just nabbed someone out of the office who wasn't doing anything better. The sergeant in question was one Rick Haddon. Nice kid, in Ratcliffe's opinion. Not pushy, and that was just what he needed. Someone quiet who would let him do the talking. They were in the interview room. He'd done the blurb for the tape and had explained yet again to Frances what her rights were and what would happen to the tapes. She had responded affirmatively to all his questions, so far.
Now, Mrs. Haynes, Frances, you stated to me earlier, in the presence of P.C. Kelly, that you were willing to explain the circumstances of Roy Baxter's death.
Yes, she said, leaning slightly towards the recorder, as if she wanted to be sure it had picked up her answer. Ratcliffe wanted to tell her that there was no need.
Go on, he urged instead.
Frances closed her eyes, giving him the impression that if she had to talk about this, she had to go back to it and rerun it in her head, like a scene from a film.
After Patsy Jones's death, Roy had become increasingly unhappy, very aggressive and unpredictable. He was often violent towards Stella, and, though he'd never physically attacked any of the rest of us, we were all very afraid of him. He could send Rachel into a fit just by looking at her. Most of the time we would just stay out of his way. He'd got it into his head that Mother had money hidden somewhere in the house, started tearing the place apart, shouting and yelling at everyone, kicking the furniture, things like that. Mother was yelling back at him, telling him that he'd had everything she had and there was no more. Anyway, he went upstairs and tried to get into her bedroom. She always kept it locked. None of us were ever allowed in there. It was her private space. There was a scuffle on the landing and he hit Mother. He wanted the key to her room, was convinced she had cash hidden in there. I tried to pull him off her, but he pushed me to the ground. He was dragging Mother along the landing by her arm. She was screaming and screaming. Stella was there too. She just curled herself up into a ball in the corner. She always did when he got started. Anyway, I don't really remember how it all happened, but Delia appeared out of nowhere. I didn't even know she was in the house. She had the iron in her hand, must have picked it up from downstairs. I think Stella had been ironing a shirt for Roy. That's what he wanted money for. He wanted to go out. Anyway, she hit him hard over the back of the head. He fell on the floor. I remember getting up and going over to him. He was out cold. I felt for a pulse, but I couldn't find one. I thought he was dead. Ratcliffe interrupted. Are you telling us that Delia Jones killed Roy Baxter? It was hard to keep the incredulity out of his voice. Please, I haven't finished, she'd said impatiently, eyes still closed, still picturing the scene. He lay on the floor, not moving. She stood there with the iron in her hand. Mother was hysterical, I was terrified. It had been bad enough when Patsy had died, now there was another body. I didn't think any of us could face all that again. Mother kept saying, get rid of him, so we did. Delia and I dragged him downstairs. We rolled him onto an old blanket and carried him out on that. I thought we were going to bury him or put him in the boot of his car and dump it somewhere, but Delia said no, there would be too much risk he would be found. She told me how long it would take her to dig a grave, how hard it would be. I had no idea. I'd never disposed of a corpse before. Mother had the idea of using the trunk, so Delia and I dragged him out there and lifted him in. I can remember how heavy he was, a dead weight. Oh, my God, I remember now. She gasped and put her hand over her mouth. Delia had gone outside. I was on my own, trying to force his arms into the trunk, but it was really hard. He woke up. He grabbed my wrist. I screamed. I thought he was dead, but he grabbed me. I think I must have passed out. I vaguely remember Delia with a shovel in her hands. I think she must have hit him again. Anyway, I went inside, made a cup of tea. She gave a slight laugh at the incongruity of this part of the memory. Delia and Mother covered him in salt. Rock salt, the kind used for gritting roads. God knows why, but he'd bought tons of the stuff and it stored in one of the sheds. I think it must have been one of his dodgy deals. Mother thought it would stop him rotting, stop him causing a smell. Like curing bacon, she said, which is what you do with dead pigs. What happened then? Ratcliffe asked. We drank tea, agreed that we would say he'd left. Stella packed his clothes and his things. We put it in the car. Delia drove it somewhere and got rid of it. I don't know where, I didn't care. That's what we told Rachel, that he'd just left. She was the only person who'd ever asked where he'd gone. The next time I saw him was when we cleared the house.
But you knew the body was there. You knew he would be found.
Yes. Of course I knew. Why didn't you report his murder to the police at the time?
This was from D.C. Haddon.
It wasn't an option.
Why not? He demanded.
Mother would never have allowed it. Besides, we were all involved, all implicated. We'd all played a part in it.
But it was Delia Jones who struck the blow, Ratcliffe said.
Delia Jones had struck many blows. She had my mother in the palm of her hand. Stella was more terrified of her than she was of Roy. None of us argued with Delia, not if we knew what was good for us.
I don't understand. She was your cleaner, Haddon said, glancing down at the file in his hand.
That's what people were told. That's what we allowed them to believe, but Delia was never a cleaner. Not for us, anyway. Mother called her my nemesis. Don't ask me why, I don't know, but she had some hold over her, over all of us. She knew all our secrets, all our weaknesses. She made threats to expose things that would hurt us.
Like what? Ratcliffe asked.
He was curious now. He still didn't believe a word of it, but he was curious. I don't know what Stella told you when she was here, but it doesn't matter now. It's not going to hurt her or Mother. Her father used to rape her. We all knew, but no one did anything. Mother despised him by then, and so did I. Not that I understood what was happening at the time. I just thought he preferred her to me. Go on, Ratcliffe said, unwilling to let her pontificate on that particular situation. Well, Delia knew too. When Stella got pregnant by him, she and Mother delivered the baby. I can remember sitting on the attic stairs, listening to Stella scream for hours. I saw Delia come out of the room with Mother. She had a bag, an old shopping bag, one of those things with the zip across. She put it on the floor on the landing. Father was still there then. He was shouting downstairs. He was drunk. They went down. When they had gone, I crept down the stairs and looked in the bag. There was a towel inside. I opened it up and saw a baby there. It wasn't moving. I hadn't even known Stella was pregnant. I just thought she was getting fat. I was so young. I picked it up, the baby. I was fascinated. I could hear Stella crying in the room, so I went in. She was crying for the baby, so I gave it to her. She told me they had tried to kill it. Delia had held the towel over its mouth when it was born and had put it in the bag. Mother had told her to get rid of it. Stella told me to lock the door, so I did. We locked them out. I asked Stella where it had come from. She told me about her and Father. I didn't know much at the time, but I knew that was wrong. I can't really remember how it all came about, but Mother threw Father out that night. I think he went to the flat above the shop for a while. Stella wouldn't part with the baby. It was dead, but she wouldn't give it up. Mother had to force it away from her in the end. I never knew what happened to it until Rachel found it in the house that day. I guess they did the same to it as we did to Roy. I remember that bloody bag, though, like it was yesterday. Anyway, we all had something on each other then. Delia had something on Mother. We had something on her. We were all tied together in a great big mess. By the time Roy got killed, it was a way of life. What did Delia want from your mother? Money. It's what everyone wanted. Her, Roy, Patsy, they all did. It was why we never had any too many hands in the pot. What did Patsy Jones have to do with it? Haddon wanted to know. He was still playing catch-up from the file. She found out about Rachel's parentage. She and Roy were going to run off together. She was convinced there must be money to be had somewhere. Roy hadn't managed to bully it out of us, so she did some rooting, put two and two together, and came up with four. She tried to blackmail Mother. Mother just laughed at her, so she tried Stella, threatened to have Rachel taken into care. Stella had pretty much lost the plot by then, and Rachel was the only thing she lived for. She panicked. It was Stella who killed Patsy. She got a kitchen knife and stabbed her, left her in the hallway, then went to pick Rachel up from school as if it never happened. Of course, Charlie found her there later, and he was charged with killing her, but it wasn't him. You knew this, and you let an innocent man go to prison? Haddon asked. She was family. He was the son of a woman who had dominated us for years. He was nothing. Patsy was nothing. What would you have done? She said it so calmly, as if it were a matter of fact and it stood to reason. For a fraction of a second, Ratcliffe felt himself inclined to see her point.
Did you witness Stella kill Patsy?
No, but I knew she had. She was the only one in the house. Everyone else was out. I knew it wasn't Charlie. I saw him walk into the house just before Stella and Rachel did. It was as if she was describing an average, normal event, like the dustbin being collected on a Monday.
So did you keep your mouth shut to get some kind of vicarious revenge on Delia Jones? Ratcliffe asked.
She thought about it for a moment, then shrugged. Maybe. I don't know. It was just simpler to allow things to take the course they did.
Ratcliffe was having trouble getting his head around just how fucked up this family was. Haddon was flicking through the file like a mad thing, trying to bring himself up to speed with all the characters in this insane play. Ratcliffe had a macabre image in his head that he just couldn't shake off.
So you didn't know that the baby was still in the house?
Not until my husband informed me, no. Where is my husband, anyway?
Ratcliffe looked away, didn't speak.
He's left me, hasn't he?
I thought he might, she said with resignation. He never did like a mess.
Ratcliffe leaned forward.
You've told us quite a story, Francis. There's only one problem. There is no one who can corroborate it.
Oh, yes, my mother can.
Your mother is dead, Mrs. Haynes, Haddon said coldly.
Yes, I realize that, but she kept a diary. I didn't find it in the house, so it must have been with the other body. It's all in there.
If there hadn't been a tape running, Ratcliffe would have sworn. He would have uttered the worst, most profane words in his vocabulary.
A diary, was all he said.
Yes, it's red with a little lock.
So we're looking for a red diary in a house that's just burned down, he added.
Francis shrugged. She will have left it with the other body. Ratcliffe knew for a fact that there had been no diary with that body, just like he knew there had been no ring on Roy Baxter's finger. He had stuck his neck out to listen to a fairy tale.
So what do you think happened to Stella, and who do you think burned down the lines? He asked, unable to hide the weariness in his voice.
Delia Jones, of course. It's why I asked you to place someone with Rachel. She's not safe.
Now that Roy's body has been found, none of us are safe.
She killed Stella. She burned down the house to hide any other evidence. And she's out to get Rachel. She knows we'll talk. None of us has anything to lose.
But Rachel doesn't know about any of this. Why would she be at risk? Or was there something Rachel hadn't told them? Ratcliffe wondered.
No, she doesn't know anything. But she is back on the scene with Charlie. Delia won't allow that. Rachel is a threat.
Ratcliffe suspended the interview there. He had heard enough. If he had been allowed to, he would have thrown both tapes in the bin there and then. Back in the office, he apologized to Haddon.
It's all right, Gov. Quite entertaining, really. I always wanted to be in on a case where the butler did it. It was a bit like Cluedo in there, housekeeper on the landing with the iron. He laughed.
Ratcliffe sighed and rubbed his hands over his face. Oh, this bloody case is driving me mad. I have just spent God knows how long listening to a complete fairy tale in there.
Don't worry about it. I've read the file. You have enough forensic evidence to see her away for life. She can say what she likes. She's got no brief. She's off her rocker. And she doesn't stand a chance in court, Haddon said reassuringly.
Yeah, but I still have to find a suspect for the fire and Stella Baxter's murder.
And you think it's a little old lady? According to this, Delia Jones is 77 years old, Haddon said, handing Ratcliffe the file.
And Harold Shipman was a GP, Ratcliffe said quietly, fishing his phone out of his pocket to phone Angie and let her off the hook.
Chapter 35 Charlie let Amy and Diana have first dibs on the bathroom. By the time he'd had his turn, Amy had disappeared into her room to sleep off the long night, and Diana was tidying his kitchen.
Feeling better? She asked, handing him a cup of tea.
You look better.
Physically, he felt cleaner.
He'd had better days with his body, which was shot with accumulated exhaustion. Mentally, he felt like he'd been abducted by aliens and dropped into some surreal parallel universe.
You should get some sleep, Diana said.
I should do a lot of things.
He wandered through to the lounge and sat down on the sofa, easing his aching limbs into its softness and groaned.
I should go back soon, see if there's any progress. You should get some rest, or you'll be no good to man or beast.
Their phone if there's any change, Diane told him. There was no doubt in her mind that Rachel would recover. There was every concern in her mind about what would happen next. Was it possible that Rachel could stay on with Charlie and Amy and resume a life that had barely started? It was equally difficult to imagine that she could just go back to London and carry on the life, no, the existence that she had there. Whatever line had been drawn in the past had been overstepped now. There could be no going back either way. Diana's concern was whether any of them were ready for what might come next.
What happens when she gets better?
What then?
If she gets better, Charlie said with a degree of resignation that surprised Diana.
You don't think she will?
I don't think she wants to. Why would she?
For Amy, if nothing else?
Maybe even for you?
Charlie shook his head.
I don't know. I can't think about that. I thought things might change when she knew the truth, but I just can't picture a resolution. I certainly can't see a happy ending. None of us are in control of this anymore. It's like watching a train crash in slow motion. More and more crap keeps happening. Things coming back to haunt us, to haunt her, and it's not done yet. There will be more. How can she find a way out of it, even if she does get better?
His voice had risen with every sentence, illustrating the escalation of events that had left him feeling so utterly hopeless.
Please don't tell me that time heals and that love conquers all. I'm sure those things are true, but not for us. Time keeps throwing up more and more crap. Time is closing the gaps between events, not widening them. As for love, we might feel it, I feel it, but none of us know how to do it. Not one of us knows how to conduct ourselves as loving people. Look at us. We haven't got a clue.
Diana couldn't think of a thing to say. He was right. Every time one of them tried to express love and care, it backfired. Their interpretation of the thing was all wrong. They were so busy trying to protect everyone else, save everyone else, and sacrifice themselves,
that they just ended up hurting each other in the worst possible ways. Lies, secrets, death, chaos. Diana was a great believer in the concept that charity began at home. Her interpretation was that one had to take care of oneself first in order to help others. None of these people knew how to be kind to themselves. Consequently, they were inadvertently cruel to each other. Charlie was right. None of them had a clue. Even Amy, the most stable of the lot, had grown up with the lie of her mother's death, an untruth formed to protect her by the people who claimed to love her. If that was her example, how would she manage the next steps? On the train journey they had shared, Amy had explained that she was training to be a psychiatric nurse, so that she might understand what made people tick, learn to see what they needed in order to be well again. The girl was looking for a toolkit, one that should have been provided by her family, but they had never had the tools to pass on. With this in mind, she patted Charlie on the shoulder. "Let's just concentrate on Rachel getting better for the time being." There wasn't much else she could say. Charlie gave her a weak smile and drank his tea. His jaw ached where he'd been gritting it for so long. All he wanted to do was get in his van and drive anywhere, somewhere, as long as it wasn't here. Knowing that Rachel was in London, that she had left of her own accord, that she didn't want him, had been far more bearable than this. Now the damage had been done and he only had two options. Watch her die in that hospital bed, or watch her live and struggle on. He wasn't sure which would be more painful, but he did know which would hurt for the longest. Instinct demanded that he find someone to blame, and his mind erred towards his mother. She was so certain that she was doing the right thing, always had been. He supposed it was because she'd had a tough life and she'd had to survive the hard way. It had made her a hard woman. She had corners, and you knew all about them if you ran into one. He couldn't remember his father, had never known him. But there were early memories of his mother, indistinct, fleeting, that suggested a softer woman than the one he knew. Memories of a time when she even looked different, when she had laughed sometimes, smelled nice, felt soft. He couldn't picture her back then, but he knew that she was nothing like the tough, determined, single-minded woman he'd grown up with. Delia Jones didn't believe in harping on about the past. You just put it behind you and carried on. You didn't talk about it, you didn't dwell on it. You just kept moving forward. No, he couldn't blame her. She had done her best. She'd put up with Valerie Porter for years just to put food on the table. She had been loyal to that woman through thick and thin. Surely that had to count for something, for some strength of character. He wished he'd inherited her fortitude, however misguided it might have been. That way he might have been able to put the blame at his mother's door and let himself off the hook. He should have taken her advice all those years ago and kept well away from Rachel, kept well away from all of them. That was the only thing he could blame his mother for, binding their lives too closely with the Porters. The rest had been his fault. All his. Diana was right. Perhaps they should just focus on whether Rachel would pull through. Move forward. Don't dwell, he told himself. Delia Jones, however, was busy breaking her own code. It wasn't so much that she was dwelling on the past. It was more that the past was dwelling in her head. Normally, things just unfolded in a logical, orderly manner. All her actions were dictated by events as they came along. She just did what she needed to do and moved on. But something had changed. Things had started to unravel. The past and the future were colliding unpleasantly in her mind, creating disorder and confusion. It felt like as soon as one disaster was cleared up, another one was about to happen. Given that everything she had ever done had been so carefully managed, she couldn't understand what was going wrong. Obviously, when Valerie died, someone would find Roy in the shed, and she had planned for that. Francis's hair and an earring were in his hand. They had been there for a long time. She had put them there herself when the silly bitch had fainted. If that failed, if the evidence had been destroyed by time, she had made sure that the blame would fall on Stella. It had been a lot of hard work over the years to make Stella pay for her part in things. It had taken time and patience to derail her sanity to the extent where no one would give her credibility. It had been a slow drip method, but it had worked. The woman was as mad as a box of frogs. But for some reason, and Delia couldn't fathom why, it had gone wrong. Stella had fought back. Delia had been surprised that the police had let Stella go so quickly. What she hadn't anticipated was that Stella would go back to the house, that she would scrawl all over the walls and tell everyone everything. It had only been chance that Delia had found her there at all. She had gone to the Limes to look for Valerie's diary. It had been obvious that Francis had already looked and had probably burned it, but Delia needed to be sure. With Francis banging her head and ending up in hospital, she hadn't had the chance to check whether it had been found and destroyed. When she got to the house, Stella was there, scribbling over the walls like some demented child doing lines on a blackboard. It had been a split-second decision to kill her, and a split-second more to make the decision to burn the house down. If the book was there, it would go up with the house, and with a bit of luck, Stella would go with it. Frances had used petrol to light the bonfire. There had been plenty left in the shed, plus turpentine, meths, old newspapers and rags. Delia had used the lot, spreading them all around the house to make sure it all burned well. Then she had gone to the flat, hadn't thought it through, hadn't been thorough, hadn't taken a key, had panicked and tried to do the job too quickly. Not that it mattered, nothing in the flat would point back, but it would have been better if it looked like Stella had done it. It had all happened in the wrong order. That was the problem when you were under stress. Delia didn't do stress, didn't like split-second decisions, never had, but she'd had to make a few over the years. But this time something had gone wrong. She had been thinking about it for days, trying to track things back to the point where it had all started to fall apart. Everything linked to Rachel coming back. If she hadn't come back, if Charlie hadn't seen her, if Amy hadn't found out, everything would have panned out fine. Delia didn't do panic. Didn't react wrong, but she had that night. When she'd foreseen the loss of Charlie and Amy because of Rachel, her talent for thinking on her feet had lapsed. She had told Charlie the truth, or a version of the truth, and she couldn't believe she had laid herself open like that. Everything had collapsed so fast, and the words were out of her mouth before she'd realized. Stupidly, she had sent him running. Only after he had gone had she realized that Rachel might tell a different story. Might tell him that it was Delia who had told her he was the father, not Valerie. This was the problem where lies strayed too far from the truth. She had to tell Rachel that Frances was her mother for two reasons. First, Rachel would never have believed Charlie would sleep with Stella. And second, Rachel and Frances hated each other. They weren't likely to talk. Rachel had already turned her back on Valerie and Frances. She might not have felt so strongly if she thought that Stella was her real mother. But that hadn't been the point. Delia's mind was mixing it up again, getting confused. Rachel had been about to take Charlie and the baby away, move them to London, away from home, away from Delia. That couldn't happen. Rachel had to go. It was easy to kill people who wouldn't be missed, like Roy, like Barrington, like Molly Kerr. Rachel would have been missed. There would have been trouble. It had been a risk, but it had paid off. A calculated gamble that Rachel, meek and pathetic, wouldn't question what she was being told. A low self-esteem was a powerful thing in Delia's experience. A useful tool when you wanted to convince a girl she only had a ring on her finger because a man felt guilty about an unplanned baby. The more she went over it, the less sense it made. Everything was disjointed. She couldn't remember the logic of it all anymore. It used to fit. Everything had fitted perfectly. Now it didn't. Pieces were missing. Things had gone wrong. If Rachel hadn't come back, if Rachel hadn't done the sensible thing and topped herself like anyone else would have in her shoes, and God knows Delia had hinted at it enough over the years. Like with Stella, she had drip-fed guilt and shame and doubt into the kid, only to see the little shit grow up and try to take her son. In sheer rage, she swept her arm across the mantel and sent its contents flying. No one took what Delia didn't want them to take. No one. Chapter 36. Angie tried Ratcliffe's number yet again. Still no answer. The stupid git must have switched his phone off. She left yet another message and ended the call with a sigh. How was she supposed to help solve this thing if she was stuck at a hospital, minding an unconscious woman and, for that matter, why exactly was she minding Rachel? Ratcliffe knew something she didn't, and the fact that he was pushing her out of the loop was making her really, really angry. Frustrated, she returned to the ward and resumed her vigil by Rachel's bed, and watched the hypnotic movement of the respirator as it forced oxygen in and out of the woman's failing lungs. "What's so special about you, then, that you deserve a babysitter, eh?" she asked the inanimate woman quietly. "Know something you haven't told us? Is that it?" All she got in response was the dull thunk of the machine. Angie knew she shouldn't be there. She should be following up on the information Pam and her mother had given her, working out the links between Delia Jones and Valerie Porter. More to the point, working out the link between Delia and Charlie. If what Pam had told her was true, there was no way that Charlie could be Delia's son. So who was he and how did he fit into the picture? Decisively, she stood. Sod this, there was no way she was hanging around in a hospital for nothing. Ratcliffe could bawl her out later if he wanted.
Besides, there were plenty of staff in the ICU, so it was hardly likely that anything would happen to Rachel any time soon. Angie decided that it was worth the risk and left. To her relief, as soon as she switched her phone on, there was a message from Ratcliffe telling her she was free to leave. She headed back to the station, only to find that Ratcliffe had buggered off to get his car cleaned, and had left Haddon to fill her in on the interview with Francis. She sat at her desk and mulled over what she had just been told. It sounded like a complete fantasy designed to divert attention from Francis. But Angie already had suspicions about Delia, and decided a little more checking wouldn't go amiss. She fired up her computer, found the screen she needed, and typed in the name Barrington Jones. "What's so special about you?" Rachel heard the question, but couldn't for the life of her work out where it was coming from. She appeared to be in a waiting room, dressed in a hospital gown. There was some reason she was there, but she couldn't remember it. Though the room she was in was bare to the point of starkness, it was strangely peaceful. If she wanted to, it felt as though she could just drift off to sleep and be peaceful forever. So nice, so tempting. Somewhere outside the room there was noise and activity, but she didn't need to worry about it. It didn't have anything to do with her, she was just waiting. However, the question that had floated through the air bothered her. There was nothing special about her, nothing at all. No point to her existence, in fact. But she guessed whoever had asked the question already knew that, was being rhetorical. What was it she was waiting for?
Chapter 37 Amy reached her grandmother's house and was surprised to find that she couldn't get in. Strange that Delia hadn't mentioned that she was going out. Nevertheless, with a confident shrug, she lifted up the garden gnome that hid the spare key and let herself in. The kitchen was a mess, the crockery from breakfast still languishing on the table. The fridge was wide open, the milk on its side slowly dripping onto the floor. Someone had ripped open a box of tea bags and had just let them spill all over the floor, and loose sugar glittered the worktops like early morning frost. Amy had never seen Delia's house in such a state, and it made her panic. "Gran?" she called, running through to the next room expecting to find her grandmother collapsed somewhere with a broken hip or something. The mess in the lounge was even worse than the kitchen. Broken china and glass lay everywhere, as if someone had taken a baseball bat to all the ornaments and swept them from their shelves in a fit of violence. Drawers lay open, their contents spilling on the floor. The cushions on the sofa had been slashed, their foamy innards disgorged. Adrenaline coursed through Amy's body as she searched through the rest of the house, convinced that she would find Delia beaten and bloody somewhere. The house was empty. Frantic with fear, Amy dialed 999, sure that the house had been burgled. Gran would go apeshit, all her things were trashed. God knows how Amy would tell her. She waited agitated while she was put through to the police. The calm female voice on the end of the phone wanted to know if anything had been taken. It was such a mess that Amy found it hard to tell. The obvious things were still there, the TV was present, though it had been tipped over, and Delia's jewellery was scattered all over the bedroom. It didn't look like anything had been stolen at all, just wrecked. The woman wanted to know if there were any signs of forced entry, but Amy had to use a key to get in, and all the windows were shut and unbroken. She was advised to go and sit with a neighbour until the police turned up, but she didn't fancy tea and questions from anyone just then. She just wanted to find Delia and phone her dad. Charlie's phone cut straight to the answer service, meaning he was probably at the hospital and switched it off. When she tried Delia's phone, she heard it ring from somewhere under the debris in the sitting room. She had an overwhelming urge to sit down and cry. She had no idea what on earth she should do. Feeling frightened and alone, she half sat, half leaned on the edge of a shredded armchair, clutching her phone and praying that Charlie would ring. The woman at the control center had told her not to touch anything in the house, but it was difficult to just sit amidst the chaos and do nothing but wait. Who on earth would do this to an old lady's home? Everything that had represented Delia was gone, smashed and ruined. A whole life trashed in the blink of an eye. It felt like a whirlwind had whipped through the house and turned it upside down. Everyone knew that Delia loved junk, but to see it all shattered like this just made it look all the more ridiculous and tawdry. Headless kittens, limbless glass clowns, an eye here, a tail there, photographs torn apart in a frenzy, china dolls grotesquely disfigured by the destruction, their faces chipped and cracked, their dresses torn. Now that it was all broken, it had taken on a sinister feel. There was a creeping doom about the place that Amy started to find disquieting. Instinctively, she got up and picked her way back through the mess, deciding to wait for the police outside where the air was cleaner and she could shake off the sense of impending threat.
The gnome that hid the key grinned up at her with big Disney eyes. It made her shudder, so she kicked it, figuring one more broken thing wouldn't make much difference today. Just as Pam's mother had said, Barrington Jones had been a pimp. He was well known to the police, and before his death, wanting for questioning in connection with the disappearance of Molly Kerr and her son. Molly had been working for him, and had been reported missing by one of his other girls. No trace of her or the child had ever been found, and when they had finally caught up with Barrington, he was beyond giving any account of himself. He was found in an alley, his body bloated with drugs and his skull caved in. Technically, the case was still open, but no one bothered too much about pimps and whores, especially back then. The loss of Barrington Jones had been a good thing for the town, and one less whore and her kid was no great loss to anyone if the attitudes of the time were to be believed. Angie found no record of him ever marrying Delia, or of Delia ever marrying anyone for that matter. She had just taken his name and become another anonymous-sounding Jones. It also seemed like she had just melted away into the ether for a year or so afterwards, just like the other woman who had worked for Jones. The next time Delia had popped up was over a year after, with a 3-year-old child in tow. The people she had associated with back then had loose morals, loose tongues, and unfortunately loose memories, too. No one had cared that Delia had acquired a child of 3. The only thing that had mattered to Delia's old associates was where their next drink was coming from. Besides, Delia had become respectable, so what was she to them anymore? Angie had found most of this out from a retired officer who had worked the case. She had tracked him down to his allotment and had shared a cup of tea with him in his potting shed while they talked over old times. He had been amused by her interest in a case that only received cursory attention at the time. His attitude had been that sometimes it was better to let sleeping dogs lie. She had asked him what he had thought of Delia back then. He had laughed and referred to her as a hard-faced cow. Delia's career on the game had been brief, and she hadn't caused them too much trouble, as he recalled. Somehow the picture didn't tally with the cuddly granny image presented by Delia now. Angie had asked him if they had ever considered that Charlie Jones might be the son of Molly Kerr. He'd shrugged, mulled it over, and asked her if it really mattered anymore. Angie had thanked him for his time and made her exit, deciding that it mattered a great deal. She got back to the station just in time to find Ratcliffe extracting himself from an extremely small courtesy car. "Don't you dare laugh, Watson," he huffed as she approached him. "Wouldn't dream of it, sir. Want to know what I've been doing while you've been playing in your naughty car?" While she was filling him in on her day's work, a memo was placed on his desk, informing them that Delia's house had been the target of an apparent burglary. A computer program had flagged up the name and address, linking it to their case. A conversation with the uniformed officers who had attended told them that nothing had been taken and that there were no signs of forced entry to the property. "What the hell?" Ratcliffe asked as he put down the phone. "Are we really considering that a 77-year-old woman is a serial killer who is still active?" he asked Angie, looking as though he was sincerely hoping that she was going to firmly disabuse him of the notion. Angie nodded slowly and watched him sigh heavily and hold his head in his hands. "I don't effing believe this," he said through his fingers. "So where the hell is she now? According to uniform, she hasn't been back to the house all day." Angie shrugged, and then realization dawned. "Why exactly did you make me stay at the hospital earlier, boss?" Ratcliffe waved his hand dismissively. "Some stupid deal I had with Frances Haynes to get it to talk. A precaution, really. She was convinced Rachel was at risk because of what happened to Stella." His words trailed off and he shot out of his chair. "Shit, she was telling the truth!" he yelled. Angie was already walking towards the door. Charlie had left Diana in the hospital canteen, claiming that he needed some fresh air and to stretch his legs. Besides, he needed to put another ticket on the van, which reminded him that he'd thrown the London parking ticket into the footwell. He ought to retrieve it and sort it out before the fine escalated. Anything to distract him from the oppression of sitting next to Rachel's bed, feeling as though he was waiting for her to die. Instead, he'd left his mother there. She could deal with these situations better than anyone. It had been a long time since he wanted to cry. The last time had been the day after Rachel had left, when the shock and anger had subsided and the sense of rejection had set in. Now she was threatening to leave them again, and he just didn't think he could take it. Not that he would blame her if she just gave up the fight, but it would break him all over again. Wearily, he bent down to rummage in the van, groping under the seat for the screwed-up ticket. His hand found something unexpected. It felt like a small book. Confused, he pulled it out, sure that it didn't belong to him. It looked like a diary, an old one. The binding worn, the small brass catch that held it shut, scuffed and tarnished.
He vaguely remembered seeing it in Rachel's bag at the hotel, but hadn't paid much attention to it. He figured that she must have dropped it in the van when he'd taken her back to London. Dare he look inside? Find out what she had written over the years they'd been apart? Or was he better off not knowing? He waited in